Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quick. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our culture. These pressures can feel overwhelming. And when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to. And that's not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finances, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Carrie Hartunian-Smith. Carrie works with business owners and entrepreneurs to develop accelerated growth strategies in highly competitive industries. She creates and executes strategic growth plans, directing integrations and marketing automation, as well as manages projects and establishes benchmarks for success. Her expertise in fostering winning cultures, increased productivity, and reducing costs in mission-driven environments are just a few of her recognized talents as a talented and accomplished leader. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Lynn, for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm so excited about doing this because I actually had the opportunity to listen to a podcast you've done with our mutual friend, Stephen Wessner. And I heard some wonderful things that I certainly want to make sure we talk about in a little different context now because we're doing this kind of a podcast. But let's start with some of the things that you talked about in regard to how you transitioned, I'm going to use that word, from being an employee to someone who was an entrepreneur. So there were some wonderful expressions of, I guess you would call them emotions, for lack of a better term, about how you felt when you made that transition. And I so completely relate to that because I did something like that myself. And so when you started talking about it, I went through all those things in my head and relived all that business. But I just think, first of all, let's start with the story of how you got involved with a family business. You took it from $60,000 a month of revenue to $7 million a month in revenue, and then the business was sold. So now you go from being a highly efficient entrepreneur to an employee, and then from an employee to being back to an entrepreneur. So tell me about that transition. How did all of that happen, and how did you feel about that?
Yeah, so those days, it seems we were just talking about timelines a little while ago as far as how fast time flies. And when I hear you say that back to me, I'm like, that was forever ago. My father and I started a business back in 1993, he had one client, and I knew nothing about the industry that we were going into. He came home one day. I was working in management, and I was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. And he says, "Hey, do you want to go into business with me?" And I'm like, "Okay." I had no idea what it was, what we were going to do. And we had one client that which was doing $60,000 a month. And in the first year, we took it to $7 million. And then when we sold in 2012, we were, I'm trying to remember, we were like in the $75 to $80 million in revenue, in gross revenue. So in that time, in that 14-year span, every year we had explosive growth with revenue and building our business with staff members as well. And when the company, so I mean, at that point, you know, that's where I cut my teeth really with a career. You know, I had jobs before, but that turned into my career. And when the company sold, I knew I was going to be able to stay on with the new company if I wanted. And they asked me to, and, you know, we created it. So of course I wanted to stay on, and of course I wanted to see, you know, what I could do moving forward with, the new ownership. And I did stay on with them for about 5 years. I probably learned more in those 5 years than I had learned in the 14 years. But we went from a mom and pop, you know, high grossing, you know, revenue company to now a private venture capital backed company, and all the game rules changed. So it was a pretty big culture shock, just that in and of itself, going from building a family run company to selling it and now being in a, you know, VC backed, you know, New York, LA corporation. Our COO was in New York, our CEO was in LA, and they play by different rules. You know, and of course I had a target on my back. I was the former owner's daughter. And, I remember when they gave me my first title, it came with a condition, and it said, this title lasts 6 months. So basically figure it out. And, you know,
Are you kidding? Tell me. What was the title?
It was VP of New Business Integration.
Oh, okay. So then after 6 months, what happened?
The title stayed, and I got in, and I did what I was able to do. You know, look, I think the one thing that has made me successful, which you haven't asked me this, but successful in life, whether it's personal or professional, is that I've just been blessed to be at the right place at the right time and use the gift that I believe God has given me. And what that gift is getting in there and figuring it out. And that's if you were to ask me what my gift is, it is that, you know, and I have the attitude of, which I'm finding the older I get, the less I see out there, and you can say, oh, it's the millennials, or oh, it's this group of people, but all too often people will give you 6 reasons why something can't be done instead of looking at the impossible and figuring out how it can be done. And, you know, I think that's what I did. I was given what was a tough, and it wasn't an impossible situation that they put me in, but I looked at it as opportunity, and I said, okay, you know, no matter what happens, I'm going to learn something here, and it's going to propel me to the next place in life. And so I took that same attitude when I decided to leave corporate America. And everyone thought I was crazy. You know, I had built the first rendition of the company, and I was an integral part of building the second rendition of the company, meaning when we were acquired. And so I was really in it. I mean, I was in it. I was definitely in it. My being was in every aspect of that business. And when I gave my notice, I don't know who was more shocked, me or the employees. But they're like, we thought you were going to die here. I'm like, I did too.
Well, let me ask you something about that. When you said, because I've heard the story that you were talking about, that when you went with this new VC-backed company, your responsibility was to try to integrate, I believe it was 5 companies now into one, correct?
Yep. We were the first of 5 companies that they acquired. A week later, they acquired another company. And then a year later to the date, they acquired 2 more large companies, one in Jacksonville, Florida, and another one in Pennsylvania. Then about 6 months later, we acquired another smaller company. And so my job was part of the acquisitions. To get going, onboarding and, you know, doing all the fun stuff with acquisitions. But then once we acquired these companies, they were all in the same industry, but different aspects. But they were all, interestingly enough, family-based companies. So I understood what it was like to be part of a family-run company, whether you were for the family or not. You know, it's a different culture. And, you know, when I think back to it, you know, how we talk about connecting the dots of our life, one of the Not one of my first jobs, but, you know, one of my earlier jobs, I worked in the restaurant industry, and I worked for a family-run company, and that was my first taste of working for a family-run company, and so I saw the good, bad, and the ugly, and I was able to bring that into my family-run business, and so, again, I just feel like I was at the right place at the right time, and things were lined up for me to handle the events as my life moved forward.
And then you mentioned that you reached a point where you said, why am I doing this? So did you have any stake in this new entity? Were you an owner or did you own some shares of this company?
No, I had some shares, you know, but as much as I'm, well, I guess that you could argue, I was going to say, as much as I think I'm conservative with money and spending and saving and all that, I guess you could look at parts of my life and say, no, you're not.
Well, if you're an entrepreneur, you're not, by definition.
Yeah. But it was never a money thing for me. You know, I made a nice salary. I certainly wasn't becoming a millionaire working there by any means because of that job. You know, I have other investments. But you know, it was this, I love to get involved in something and see it through. And I love to make a difference in people's lives, whether that is employees in and around me or whether that's clients that I can help move to that next level and look at their problems and figure out how to turn that into an opportunity and not have it be a problem. So for me to stay on, it was a great learning curve for me. You know, you don't get that education in school, you know, you just don't. And, so it was a huge education for me, number one. Number two, I felt needed and valued and that I could make a difference. And that's what I find as I look back, especially as I branched off on my own and I have the opportunity to work with all sorts of different clients. You know, my driving factor is, am I making a difference in this person's life?
Mm-hmm.
Am I able to help them move the needle forward, whatever that needle is for them? It's their agenda, not mine, but I want to make sure that I'm able to help them move that, you know, ball down the court, if you will.
And you mentioned also that you had done some work in the past with mastermind groups, with a lot of the consulting, self-help type programs, getting involved with mentors to some degree, and you've always found that you had great expectations about what this was going to help you with, and then the results were less than helpful.
Yeah. And for years, I was like, what's wrong with me?
I did the same thing. That's why I'm asking you this, because I was saying, how many more people am I going to support financially who aren't supporting me? So right. You know, obviously, that's the world that you're in and the world that I'm in, and to a great degree. But how do you make sure that when you're dealing with your clients, that you have some very realistic expectations and that the results are there? How do you track those results as you're going along in the relationship?
Yeah, so I really like to try to look for the small wins and then understand their big picture. Because I'm working with a client right now, and it's a huge client, actually, and I'm a small piece of what they're trying to do. And what they're trying to do is literally climb this huge mountain. And you can get lost in that. You know, you can start to go down the wrong path and all of a sudden it be the right path, or it can be a dead end. And so what I like to do, and as a consultant, for me, that can be, it's not rewarding. And I like to make sure that it's rewarding for me, so I'm giving my best foot forward. It can come back and I'm going to say slap you in the face as a consultant, because all of a sudden when things don't go right, the first person they're going to look at is, well, you're consulting me, how come it's not working, type thing.
Yeah.
So what I like to do is make sure that we have those short, small little wins. So let me give you an example. I'm working with another client, and I work – one of the services that I offer is helping people get to bestseller status on Amazon. And a lot of times they come to me just for that. And, you know, to me, it's so much more than that. I think the bestseller status is definitely something that is a huge authority build for clientele. But what's behind that. When that's over, when the hype of your bestseller launch is over, what do you have left? So I'll talk to them about putting together a marketing campaign and, you know, building whatever it is that they're trying to build from a 30,000 foot view and making it bigger and better. And so my point is that sometimes those marketing campaigns, you can get lost. That's kind of like the big mountain where, you know, they don't want to do blog posts, or they're not seeing an instant ROI on a blog post, or the funnel isn't working right, or, you know, there's so many different variables. But I like to lay that out, hit little benchmarks along the way, but at least I can deliver and say, okay, that small nugget is, we got you bestseller. That's the first thing that you came to me for, and we accomplished that. And now let's look at, you know, so check that off the list as a success, and now let's move to the next one. And chunk it down in smaller pieces to get the client realizing that although their end result hasn't happened yet, we are making progress along the line.
That's good, because I think making sure that the expectations are lined up with what you say you can do is clearly helpful. I think the times that I have worked with people who've taken me in the initial conversation of where I am to where they say I should be, it's just a huge gap to me. I can't even get my arms around it. So at the end of the day, after this relationship is completed, the 1 year term or whatever, I look back in that and I say, wow, I don't even know how that could even have been possible. But okay, that somebody, I think is defer to how other people may see me or see my potential. And that's always flattering. I mean, no matter how you look at it. But I think that there needs to be some benchmarks along the way that people can connect with and say, okay, you did that. That's good. Now I feel confident about our relationship. Let's go to the next step. But I don't think too many people do what you're doing in that world of consulting. It's like everything or nothing.
Oh, yeah. And see that, to me, I like to chunk it down. And you know, as you were talking, what came to mind is I'm working with, there, like anything in life, there's seasons. And I look at my clients as seasons, you know, being in different seasons of their business and being in different seasons of how and where I can help them. And, you know, with one client, I've been working with her for several months now. We've hit some of those benchmarks that I just talked about. And now, you know, I think some things are happening in her life where that next step just isn't coming to fruition. And I can consult her all day long, but the reality is that, she, you know, the client needs to do some of the work unless they're hiring me to do the work. But in this particular case, they're not. Right. And so we'll have a conversation here soon that says, hey, you know what? I'm happy to keep consulting with you, but your money would be better spent elsewhere. And it's not that I don't want to work with you. And it's not that I don't, you know, that I don't enjoy getting that deposit into my account every month, but I don't feel good about taking people's money unless I'm really, I can see the value that I'm bringing to the table. And I think, I've bumped into consultants out there who just want to keep that client because they want to keep that revenue going. And, I think it, for me anyways, it causes underlying stress. Like, it stresses me out. I don't want someone's money unless I'm doing something good for them. And I think that fosters, you know, ill feelings between a client, you know, client relationship. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another piece that I don't know if I do that differently or if other people are or not doing that, but I think it's really important to look at your client base and make sure that you are providing that value. And if you're not, it's okay to go to them and say, hey, it looks like maybe you need a month or two to go get to this point and then call me back and let's move you, you know, let's move that ball further down the court. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Do you know how weird that is in your world? I almost want to say, and this is probably going to, you know, look as though it's a kind of a definite bias, but it is, that I think there are men that would do that more so than women. Because I think women have a vested interest in what you said earlier, which is, if I'm not making a difference in somebody's life, then I don't feel like I can take their money. And I've done that myself several times. I've given back money and said, I can't make a difference here. So I don't know that that's necessarily true. There may be men out there who feel that way, but I can say that with the number of consultants I've worked with, there's only been one who has said that to me, a woman. So,
well, and,
in any event, I think we...
Yeah. And, you know, it's if I can just kind of tie a bow around that point a little bit. And you know, a few minutes ago, you said that you heard me say on the other podcast that, you know, you go to all of these events and, you know, you see all these testimonials and it's working for them. How come it's not working for me? One of the things that I have found oftentimes when I go to these different events and they teach you this, you know, what I'm going to call hardcore business, like you have to do it this way. What I just share with you kind of flies in the face of what a lot of people teach. And so instead of me looking at it and saying, hey, how come that doesn't work for me? I get to say, no, I'm taking bits and pieces of what they're doing to make a success. And I'm seeing how that fits for me, my integrity, how I want to run my business, and I'll take bits and pieces and form my own. And I think that's a big part of it too.
Nice job. I got to say, nice job, Carrie. Okay, so let's switch this around for a minute. I'd like to talk to you about some of those questions that you saw prior to this interview, because I'm now that I know more about who you are and your vision for things, I'm really curious to know how much of that was created by some of the things you learned as a child and as a teenager, whatever, about money, because I think it has a big impact. So the first question I would ask is, what was your family like when you were growing up?
So I was born into this nice little East Coast, you know, middle-class family. You know, I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and I was raised until I was 7 or 8 in a little town called Southington, Connecticut. And, you know, arguably, I guess you could say my recollections of my childhood back then was kind of, you know, Beaver Cleaver type, you know, two older brothers, mom, dad, you know, my parents are still married. And then in 1978, I guess, they decided to just shock the whole family, sell everything, pack up, and move across the country to Arizona, which no one had ever been to. We'd never seen anything. And back in 1978, for anyone who's listening who was ever in Arizona, it was like right out of the movies, like ghost town, gunslingers, you know, and dirt roads. And I'll never forget, we pulled into a town called Buckeye, Arizona. And all it was fields, and I saw this big, huge bull out in the field, and I turned and looked at my mom, and I'm like, I want to go home. And my dad said, look around, kids, you're home. And I'm like, what the heck? So, you know, we settled in.
Why'd
they move?
Why did they do that?
I still ask that question. I think both my parents, you know, they were in New Britain, Connecticut, small little town. I think my dad, I honestly think it was like a midlife crisis type thing where he's like, I got to get out of here, you know. And my dad is definitely entrepreneurial, you know, great sales guy, you know, honest, not shady sales guy, but honest, you know, as the day is long. I think that's where I know that's where I get a lot of my core values from. Just watching him and seeing how he interacts with people. And we always take in our business, we always took the high road. And that used to aggravate me so much when I was younger. Cause I'm like, but you know, and I used to call him Dennis. I never called him dad at the office, but I'm like, but Dennis, you know, look at, you know, this and this, we're right. They're wrong. And he goes, it doesn't matter. You know, it's our integrity. We take the high road. And, you know, as I look back at my childhood, I believe that was something that is something that is a deep fiber in him. You know, he had an interesting childhood where he was basically orphaned at 13 and was running his parents' paint shop on his own. And he has a very interesting childhood upbringing. But anyway, you know, they came out here, I think, just to start over. And it traumatized me. And it, you know, I think it messed with, you know, me as a child with my self-esteem, and we didn't have any family and we didn't have any friends. And, you know, so all of a sudden this picturesque, you know, family that we had, it got rough. You know, we moved out here. My dad was always trying to, you know, get ahead, always trying to, you know, provide for the family. I mean, that's his mission in life, is to provide for the family. And, you know, at one point they didn't lose everything, but they lost everything but the house. And I remember we had one car for 5 drivers. I was in high school. It was my first, I was 16, you know, able to drive. Our one car was a Ford Pinto, and it was the ugliest color gray you could ever imagine. Like, so talk about humiliation and, like, you know.
Oh, my gosh. How could you fit your whole family in the Pinto?
Yeah, well, we didn't do family things because no one wanted to be seen in it. It was just used to get groceries and get my parents back and forth to work. I mean, you know.
That's funny.
That, I had a lot of trauma in my childhood. financial trauma, anyway. But my point behind that is because my dad was a provider, and we always had food on the table. It might have been Kraft macaroni and cheese, where you got four boxes for a dollar, and that's what we had for dinner. You know, we lived in middle income. You know, we never lived in the bad part of town. We always lived in a nice house. But you know, with limited furniture and limited clothes. And so at a very young age, you know, I was babysitting at 9, 10. My mom had a daycare in the home. So I had, you know, babysitting jobs outside of, you know, in the evenings. And I got my first real job when I was 14. And, there was a little breakfast joint that opened up down the street, and they were looking for hostesses. And, I went and applied, and my parents were like, no, you know, you need to be a kid. We don't want you working. Be a kid. And I'm like, no, I really want to work. Because I like that instant gratification, and I excelled from the time I had that job until I think where I am today. You know, again, I was at the right place at the right time, and I took care of business, whatever the task was at hand. You know, I started waitressing. I couldn't waitress until I was 15. So I started waitressing, and I was making like $300 a weekend. And that would have been in the 80s. That was a lot of money. And, you know, my parents thankfully never asked me to pay rent at 15. And, you know, I was able to hold my own and able to go buy the makeup that I needed or wanted, or buy the clothes. So I didn't look, although we were driving a Pinto, I didn't have to look like I drove a Pinto. And, you know, from there, yeah, good times, right? But from there, my senior year, I got into one of those home ec classes where you had to work part of the year. You know, for part of your grade. And that's where I got into retail. And in my senior year, at the time, one of the most prestigious resorts in Arizona opened up, called the Phoenician Resort. And I was right place, right time. They hired me to work in the gift shops, which was right up my alley. And over 6 months, so I was 17 years old, senior in high school, and within 6 months, both of my managers had left. And all of a sudden, here I am, a manager of three boutique shops with staff being my age. And then at the time, they were, you know, 50, 60, 70-year-old ladies who were working there. So, you know, and I was making really good money at that time. So that would have been 88, 89-ish. I think I was making close to like $19,000 a year. And again, that was a lot of money for a senior in high school. And
Sure.
So needless to say, school was really hard for me because I struggled in school, but I was successful in the workplace. So, you know, that was, again, that was one of those things that I always felt bad about myself because school was so hard for me, that it took me years to realize, embrace the fact that I don't have to be good at school to be good in life. You know, I can apply myself, take my gifts and my talents, and be at the right place at the right time and do what I'm here for.
Yeah, that's an important lesson that a lot of people, a lot of parents don't get either. You know, they force kids to go to school because they think that's the ticket. And many times it just makes no sense. So
yeah.
Most
of my friends, you know, went to the 4-year school, and I did go to school, and it took me a long time to get through school. But most of my friends who did the 4 or 5 year plan, got out, had tons of student debt. They were back waitressing where I was waitressing, yet I had lots of money saved up because I had been waitressing and, you know, saving up money and building my career. So, I don't think either one is the right way to go for any one in particular. I think you have to do what's right for you and what your vision is for your own life.
What's your first memory around money?
My first memory around money was when I was babysitting. So I was probably like 8 or 9. And do you remember back in those days they had those high rise water beds? So your bed was up high, and I had all these cabinets underneath my bed, like drawers and cabinets. And I had like a little Lucite plastic jar under there that I would put my money and I would hide it and I would go and count it and I would lay it out and I would stack the quarters four tall and, you know, because they'd pay me in change and playing and touching and creating, that might sound funny, but creating like shapes out of coins and dollars. And I would do that under my waterbed.
That you have to get the prize for the best answer to that question.
And I have that waterbed for a very long time, and it got even. I did that even more for a long period of time because when I was waiting tables, all of a sudden I had a lot of, you know, cash and I had a lot of coins. And yeah, when I saw that question on your list, that's the first thing that came to my mind.
It's great. I love it. What jobs or careers have you experienced up to this time in your life after the boutique thing with gift shops? How did you get from there to the business?
So after that job, so I kind of went backwards before I went forward. So after I was a manager my senior year, and then I stayed there my first year of college. I was living this really mature life. You know, I had this mature job. I had a boyfriend who was a lot older than me. And all of a sudden, I looked at all my friends having a blast, you know, joining sororities and, you know, doing things that they probably shouldn't have been doing. But I wanted part of that. So I quit that job. And I said, I'm going to move back to Connecticut. And I went to Central Connecticut State University and did the school thing. And so I went back to waiting tables. I failed miserably at that. So I moved back to Arizona. And, you know, I was in that, okay, now what? And I wanted to go for a communications degree. And I fumbled around for several years waiting tables trying to figure it out. And then I got back into retail and I thought, okay, management is my thing and I'm going to do retail. And then that's when I was living at home. My dad came home and said, hey, you want to open this business with me? And I'm like, okay. The only thing I knew about his job is that because of the job that he had, which is he left to open this business, it allowed us to have cable TV because we didn't have any money, so we couldn't have cable TV. But he got this job in the media world, and for him to understand the media world, because he came from a construction background, we needed to get cable TV. So I was like, all right, well, your job means we have cable. It must be a cool job, so let's do it.
Okay. So then did he start the business from scratch or did he take over something that already existed?
No, he started it from scratch. So he worked for, you know, back to the Pinto days real quick. He had his own company. It failed. Someone embezzled a lot of money. So he decided to close that company down and he went to work for one of his clients in the media world. And when he did that, he just was a student. And my dad was known as the trade guru. He loves trade. And turning cash deal, taking trade and turning them into cash deals. And so he really excelled and made a name for himself in the media world, in a small niche in direct response, in a small niche of the media world, direct response in the 80s. And so that's why we needed cable. But some things were kind of going wonky after he'd been there for several years. And the person that he worked for was not spending the client's money the way it was supposed to be spent. So he thought, you know, been here, done that, you know, I need to get out so my name isn't tarnished. So he, you know, took a very bold move, left a very secure job where we were finally able to have an additional car and we got rid of the Pinto and my mom moved up to a Cougar. And and I went and bought my own little Mazda RX-7 for $1,000 or whatever. And, you know, so things were normal again. He took this leap and had a client and started that business that we talked about where we were doing $60,000 in revenue. I worked for my dad for free for the first 4 to 6 months. So I worked, I had a management, retail management job. So I worked for my dad Monday through Friday from like 7 to 4. And I worked it out with my boss that I would go to the mall and do the closing shift at the retail store. So I'd still have money until my dad could afford to pay me.
Mm-hmm. So he started with a client that started at $60,000 a month. Is that how it works?
Yep. Revenue. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Let's go back to some of these other questions. Yeah. What's been the most threatening to your financial security?
the most threatening to my financial security right now or in my past?
Whatever. Yeah. Wherever it makes sense to answer that question.
I would say not right now. I would say the most threatening thing is what's happening in the world. Like, just, you know, where's our country going? Having said that, the minute I hear those words come out of my mouth, you know, I am very familiar with many stories that, you know, in the deepest, darkest times the world that we live in has gone through, there are still people who flourish and who do really well. So whenever I start to have those fearful thoughts, or if I go down that path to say what could threaten it, I really try to say, you know what, I've never been able to plan something out and have it work out the way I expected it to, but it always works out. So what I've realized is I need to let go of what I need my vision and I need a direction. So, you know, I point my compass, but I let go of all of the little ancillary things that may or may not come up, and just have faith and know that, you know, at the end of the day, as long as I'm staying true to who I am, you know, I'm pretty faith-based. So, you know, what my purpose is here, that no matter what happens, and, you know, after I left my corporate job, you know, 4 years ago, my finance, I saved for 18 years and had a nice chunk of change. That goes pretty darn fast when you don't have as much revenue coming in. So,
sure does.
So, no matter how much you can plan and save, you don't know what's going to happen. So you just need to know, for me anyway, I'll say, I just go back to every morning knowing that, you know what? I'm going to make the best decisions that I can that are in front of me today. And I've made some really stupid decisions, and I'm still battling and dealing with some stupid decisions I've made financially that I've made, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years ago.
Let's talk about those. What are some of the best and the worst financial decisions you've ever made?
Yeah, so one of the worst decisions I made was my dad used to call me Mini Trump because, I don't know, about 12 years ago, I was buying up real estate all over the place. I don't remember how many properties I had at one time, but it was probably 7 or 8 properties, land, raw land. And here I am like, well, okay, I'm ROIing on this property. I'm ROIing on that property. Let me go buy some land. Well, land doesn't ROI. And so all of a sudden I had too many, I was off balance. And all of a sudden that money can go away a lot faster than you get. And then in that time I, you know, kind of got full of myself a little bit. And I was like, well, screw this. I'm tired of spending all this other money and improving all these other properties. I want to remodel my home. I had this vision of what I wanted my home to be. And, I did that in 2007 here in Arizona. The market just tanked right after I was able to suck out a whole bunch of equity on a particular property to pay for it, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I'm still paying for that decision.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I get that. Loud and clear. Where do you want to be financially 5 years from now?
That's a great question. You know, I want to be, and this might be a wimpy answer, but I want to be content with wherever I am. I spent so many years, speaking of my house remodel job, I spent so many years just driving and driving and driving and seeing what I could do to make more money and, you know, run these different rental properties, but still have my full-time job. And, you know, at times I had other jobs going that was crazy. I mean, it was just crazy. And all the while I'm a single mom, you know, truly a single mom. My former spouse was not in the picture at all. And I always did it under the premise of I want to create this life for my son and I need money to do that. And, you know, now my son's 16, almost 17, and now I'm looking at the clock and saying I have a year and a half before he goes off to wherever he's going to go off to. And although I accomplished a lot, there's so much on my list that I did not accomplish. And when I, you know, when they talk about the dog that catches the wheel, I was about 4 years ago, I said to myself, okay, I'm planning and doing all of this stuff. And, at the end of the day, once I get there, I have to maintain it. And that was like, holy cow. You know, to me, I didn't think about the maintenance. I just thought about achieving that goal. And then all of a sudden you achieve that goal. I built the house. I bought these properties. I did all this stuff. And now I'm like, okay, well, now I have to keep going and go even harder and faster to maintain it. And that made me feel really nauseous. So to answer your question, I'm not going to lie. to answer your question, okay, is I want to be in a place in 5 years where I'm not, where I mellow out a little bit, where if whatever I'm making, whatever revenue I'm making is I'm content with the life that I'm living. So I don't want to say I want to be, you know, 10 million in the bank and, you know, sitting on a beach, because I don't know if that's what I want to be doing, you know, in 5 years. But I can tell you this, in 5 years and in 5 months and even in 5 days, I want to work towards being at a place financially where I'm enjoying my life.
Okay.
Yeah, financially free.
We call that,
yeah,
being financially independent.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh. All right. Last question that isn't on the list. All right. That's
okay.
One that I just want you to say, whatever's there to say. What area of personal finance are you most uncomfortable with?
I would say for sure investing, like stock market type. You know, I'll tell you this. If anyone out there wants a tip on stock, call me and ask me what I just bought, and then it's going to tank, so then go buy it. Because it does, and my dad and I joke about that. You know, like the goal – back in the early days when gold was sitting at $300 or $400 and people kept saying, it's going to go. I'm like, there's no way. And like overnight it hit $800 or $900. And I'm like, dang it, I missed it. And so then about 3 years ago, they were doing that whole hubbub. It was like right around 1200 and they're like, oh, it's going to go to 2000. It's going to go to 2500.
Don't tell me you bought it.
Of course I did, because I missed out on it 10 years earlier. I certainly wasn't going to miss out on it this time.
Oh,
and literally
really?
The next day, I mean, literally the next day I called my dad. I'm like, are you looking at gold prices? He's like, yep. I'm like, did you buy it? He's like, yep. I'm like, me too. That's why it went down, because had we not bought it, you know, because, you know, I don't like to think I'm reckless, but like, it's not like I went out and bought it. I watched it for like another month or two. And it, from the time, you know, I started talking about it and doing research, it was ticking up. I'm like, okay, well, I better get in now. And literally I got in. And, so I would say that kind of stuff. I'm always on the wrong side of the fence on that one.
So you have the reverse Midas touch. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Anything you touch turns to you know what.
Yes. 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 And I believe it's in my DNA, because my dad, it's the same thing with my dad.
Okay. That's great. I love it. That's a good answer. Okay. So all of you in my Power of the Purse community, these were invaluable insights and perspectives from Carrie Hartunian-Smith, all of which can help you move your career, your life, your relationships, and your financial freedom forward. One quick thing here, Carrie. How can people get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Oh, sure. You can visit my website. It is smartmarketingconsulting.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. You can Google my name and I pop up. So I'm happy if, you know, anyone has any questions, I'm happy to, you know, shoot me an email. And I'm happy to talk to you guys.
Great. Thank you, Carrie.
Great. It was great. Great to be with you. And I enjoyed the conversation.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.